Let's take our Bibles this morning and turn to Ezekiel chapter 3. The Old Testament book of Ezekiel chapter 3. And I'll be reading to you verses 17 through 19. Ezekiel 3, verse 17, it says, "Son of man, I have made thee a watchman unto the house of Israel. Therefore hear the word at my mouth, and give them warning from me. When I say unto the wicked, Thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood I will require at thine hand. Yet if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul." You know, it certainly may be true, and is true, that most warnings fall on deaf ears. Take Noah's warnings, for example. After all the preaching that he did, he was only able to get 7 souls, those of his own household or his family, to heed those warnings. So, although it's true that few heed most warnings, at the same time, it remains my responsibility to sound the warning, no matter how many may respond to it. With that being true, I've devoted this and last Sunday's message to sharing with you some of the warnings given to us in the Bible, the Word of God. As I pointed out to you in the previous message, in looking at just the word beware as it's found in the King James Version, we find that there is actually very little that we're told to beware of. And I don't know if that surprised you or not, but that surprised me when I was putting these messages together, or last week's message, that there is actually very few actual things that we are told to beware of in the Scriptures. In the Old Testament, we're told to beware lest we forget our God in not keeping His laws, a warning that is as apropos now as it was when it was first penned. In the New Testament, as I pointed out last week, the warnings can be broken down into 2 categories, warnings about others and warnings even against ourselves. In last week's message, I addressed the others whom were warned about in the New Testament. And those others in the New Testament can be broken down into 3 groups, false teachers, Pharisees, and scribes, as used in the New Testament. Well, the warning regarding the Pharisees and the scribes couldn't have been more timely, at least for us here locally. I fully intended in the second message to move on to the New Testament warnings against ourselves. And let me tell you that it is ourselves that we should be most concerned with. We have the potential of hurting ourselves much more than others can or do. It's true, others may have the potential of harming us by vilifying us and by tarnishing our reputations in the eyes of others, and even harming us physically. Yet which is more permanent, physical or spiritual harm? Christ once declared, as recorded in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 28, he said, "And fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul." Ultimately, it's only ourselves who have the potential of destroying our souls, other than, of course, God in when all is said and done at the end. Consequently, it was my intention to address the warnings found in the New Testament, that is in the next message, it was my intention in this message, I should say, to address the warnings found in the New Testament against apostasy, against squandering what God has given us, hypocrisy, pride and arrogance, fighting amongst ourselves, covetousness, etc., etc., and other things of that kind, all of which we are told to beware of in the New Testament, and things which do need to be addressed sometime. However, because of some recent events, it's necessary for me to put those things on hold and get back to them at another time. Thursday evening, there was an AP news release to the effect that Mission to Israel Ministries was one of 5 militia anti-government organizations in Nebraska. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is run by Morris Dees, as a result of that, on Friday, I was contacted by both the local newspaper and television station wanting to interview me regarding those accusations, which I declined to do. Now, before proceeding, some people who might hear this message on tape might wonder to themselves, If you don't have anything to hide, why not do the interview? Well, those who might be wondering this have probably never been at the mercy of the editing room. They've never seen what editors can do with a quote, how they can twist and distort it and make someone to appear to say what they never said in the first place. It's what one minister who went through it at one time called media terrorism. You think you're communicating with those fellows, and then lo and behold, you find out after it's too late that they had a hidden agenda all along. Reminds me of a Christian who was thrown into the Roman arena with a lion, and he thought if he could just communicate with the beast that he could, his life could possibly be spared. And so he started talking to the lion. And before he knew it, the lion was even mumbling. And the Christian said, "Thank God, we're communicating." To which the lion replied, "I don't know about you, but I'm saying grace." So, you just don't know. Sometimes you think it's one way and it comes out to be something completely different. Therefore, in most instances, it's just wise policy to decline such interviews. Christ himself admonished us regarding this. Turn to Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10 and verses 16 and 17. Verse 16, it says, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the councils, and they will scourge you in their synagogues." Verse 16 specifically says, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be therefore wise as serpents and as harmless as doves." Now, we may not do that well, especially being wise as serpents. It's not in our nature to think as they do. Nevertheless, according to that scripture and that admonishment from Christ, we should at least aim at being both wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And don't forget that Christ warned us, beware of the scribes, as I pointed out in last Sunday's message. In other words, in many cases, or scribes, which of course was one thing at Christ's time, but certainly would be a good description of the modern media today. The reporters and editors and so forth, you could say that there are modern scribes. And he told us, Christ told us, beware of the scribes. In other words, in many cases, they simply cannot be trusted. Christ also warned us in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 6. He says, "Give not that which is holy unto the dogs, neither cast ye your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet, and turn again and rend you asunder." So, with those scriptures in mind, I decline to do any interviews. Of course, that doesn't mean that you won't be reported on anyway, and that's exactly what happened. Although the lies from the Southern Poverty Law Center should have never been reported on in the first place, if the only coverage of that scandalous AP news release was what was done on KDUH, it would hardly be worth mentioning. Again, they should have never done it in the first place, but it was pretty light and most people probably even missed it. However, the newspaper was not near so kind, and that's putting it lightly. The front page headline in yesterday's April 13, 1996 Scottsbluff Star-Herald newspaper reads, "Racist, quote-unquote, church in report. Mitchell Mann denies any links to militias." Everyone should understand this. Things are not always as they first appear. It's like a poem I've shared with this congregation before. "The milkmaid put on her coat and went out to milk the goat. She tried and tried and then she cried, 'Oh, nanny, be still.' The goat tried and tried, but then he replied, 'I'm not a nanny, I'm a bill.'" It's not always as it appears the first time. It would be wise for us to take heed to the wisdom of Solomon. In Proverbs 18 and verse 17, he wrote, "The first to plead his case seems just until another comes and examines him." And isn't that the way it is? So often the media, they have that forum, and they are always the first to plead their case. But people ought to think before they accept anything just because it's in print or because it's reported on the television or on the radio, on some radio station. They ought to understand that that's just one presentation of the situation, and that when you hear maybe the other side, maybe it'll change that the situation completely. And I'll let those who will hear this message judge for themselves whether hearing the other side of the story doesn't put a whole different perspective on what was printed in the newspaper and reported on television. The rest of this message will be devoted to exposing the deception and lies printed in this article by Andy Newman. However, before getting to the actual article, let me remind you that none of this should take us by surprise. We've been warned in Jeremiah 8 and verse 8 from the New American Standard Version, it says, "Behold, the lying pens of the scribes has made it into a lie." The lying pens of the scribes have made it into a lie. That doesn't mean that all scribes, all media people are liars. I don't believe they are. But in this day and age, we certainly have our share of them. It reminds me of the message scribbled on the bathroom wall just above the electric hand dryer. It said, "For a message from your local newspaper reporter, kindly push button." Of course, get just a lot of hot air. And sometimes that goes for preachers too. Let me remind you of what I hurriedly read near the end of the previous message. Retiring editor John Swinton verified the truth of Jeremiah's statement. The following that I'm going to share with you is a quote from the speech of retiring editor John Swinton, which he made in 1914 before the publishers, editors, journalists, and reporters attending the 1914 annual dinner of the American Press Association, AP, where the same organization that this AP, this news release came from. He said, among other things, of similar sentiment, and I quote, "There is no such thing as an independent press in America. If we accept that of little country towns, you know that and I know that. Not a man among you dares to utter his honest opinion. Were you to utter it, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. I am paid $150 a week so that I may keep my honest opinion out of the newspaper for which I write. You too are paid similar salaries for similar service. Were I to permit that a single edition of my newspaper contained an honest opinion, my occupation, like Othello's, would be gone in less than 24 hours. The man who would be so foolish as to write his honest opinion would soon be on the streets in search of another job. It is the duty of a New York journalist to lie, to distort, to revile, to toady at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread, or what amounts to the same thing, his salary. You are the tools and the vessels of the rich behind the scenes. We are marionettes. These men pull the strings and we dance. Our time, our talents, our lives, our capabilities are all the properties of these men. We are intellectual prostitutes." End of quote. The headline in yesterday's newspaper front page article again reads, "Racist quote-unquote church in report." Notice the tactic used by Mr. Newman. He begins by putting the word church in quotes. And of course, when that's done, it's to imply that we're really not a church. It's a tactic to raise doubt about our legitimacy from the very beginning of the article on. But tell me, let me ask you this. Is Andy Newman some kind of authority on what a church, what is a church and what isn't a church? I mean, what's his credentials for making such a determination? I don't know, but I doubt whether he's even a Christian. He certainly hasn't acted like one in this newspaper article. Now, before going on, I want you to know that I'm praying for Andy. And I want to ask that you would do the same thing. I'm sincere in this. I ask that you would do the same thing, that you would pray for him. Because we're told in Revelations 21:8, amongst other things, that all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. And I'm sure none of us want to see Andy be put through that. And so I want to sincerely ask that you'd pray for Andy, that God would have mercy upon him and allow him to repent. And if he's not a Christian, to come to the foot of the cross, to the blood of Christ that was shed on his behalf, to the empty tomb from which he resurrected from, and be saved. I ask that you do that. Now, for anyone wanting to know, we are a church. We meet every Sunday morning. I'm an ordained Church of Christ minister, and I preach exclusively from the Holy Bible, the inspired Word of God. Now, not only did Mr. Newman put a question in the mind of his readers concerning the legitimacy of this church, but even worse, he labeled us as being racist. Well, we should ask, whose description of racist is he using? If he's using that word to imply that I hate or despise in any way the other races, that simply is untrue, as those of you here can testify to, and the hundreds of people out on the tape ministry that receive the tapes, they can testify to the fact. You've heard me preach against racism and bigotry and hatred. On the other hand, if because I address the race question or the Jewish question, if that's what Mr. Newman is calling racism, then I plead guilty to that. Because I do address the race question, and I do address the Jewish question. I know that's not politically correct, but I'm more concerned with being biblically correct, being BC rather than PC. And the Bible does deal with race, and so there's nothing wrong. It's a minority of messages that I do deal with those issues, but I will deal with those issues. And keep this in mind, if I'm to be labeled a racist for those reasons, then he will also have to label many Jewish authors with the same aspersion. Such Jewish authors as Alfred M. Lilienthal, who is quoted by former Congressman Paul Finley in his book, They Dare to Speak Out, as saying that his, Alfred Lilienthal's, greatest accomplishment was in getting, quote, some Christians to have the guts to speak up on this, the Jewish issue. End of quote. Dr. Oscar Levy, and his in the preface to the World Significance of the Russian Revolution, on page Roman numeral 5, wrote this. He put it this way, quote, every writer who is oppressed, or a little bit later, is oppressed by the aspect of the present and embarrassed by his anxiety for the future must try to elucidate the Jewish question and its bearing upon our age. For the question of the Jews and their influence on the world past and present cuts to the root of all things and should be discussed by every honest thinker, however bristling with difficulties it is, however complex the subject as well as the individuals of this race may be. End of that quote. Are Mr. Lilienthal and Mr. Levy and hundreds of others who elucidate on these things racist? Well, if Mr. Newman is unwilling, and I'm sure he probably would be, if Mr. Newman is unwilling to label them as such, then I certainly shouldn't be for simply quoting them. Next, the buzzword anti-Semitism is employed by Mr. Newman. First sentence of the article reads, a Scottsbluff church group that sells racist and anti-Semitic literature through the mail has been named in a recent report on the militia movement issued by a national civil rights organization, end quote. Anti-Semitism is just a buzzword that's employed by certain people to engender a certain response from those who hear or read it. That's all it is. Jack Bernstein, a Jew, called it a smokescreen. Since Andy Newman labeled what I do as anti-Semitic, don't you think that he should know what a Semite is in order to know what an anti-Semite is? 99% of the people who have been trained, and I emphasize the word trained, 99.9% of the people who have been trained to use that word, including Andy Newman, I'm sure, have no idea what a Semite is. So there's no way for them to know what an anti-Semite is. The word Semite is derived from Noah's son, Shem. Noah had three sons. One of them was named Shem. And that word, Semite, is derived from Noah's son, Shem. Shemites, or what later became known as Semites, are the descendants of Shem. And since I'm one of those descendants, let me ask you, how can I be an anti-Semite? It just doesn't make sense. Continuing with the newspaper article, second paragraph, he wrote, Mission to Israel Ministries is one of five groups in Nebraska that the Southern Poverty Law Center mentions in its False Patriots, the threat of anti-government extremists. End of that quote. Well, who's this Southern Poverty Law Center anyway? They're mentioned as if they're some kind of authority. And regrettably, just because they are used in that fashion, most readers will accept them as probably being just that. But ask yourself, and maybe Mr. Newman should have done the same thing. Maybe he should have done some research on these people. You know, he might be liable for what the things that this particular organization does. He and this paper could possibly be liable for a lawsuit. Because I'm sure he didn't check into his source to find out what they're about. What makes this organization an authority? Maybe they're the real racist and hate mongers. Obviously, they're not much of an authority. After all, they identified Mission to Israel as a militia organization. And as I pointed out to Mr. Newman, I've never even attended a militia meeting. I've never even been at a meeting. So if they've got that wrong, why should anything else they say be given consideration? You know, it'd almost be humorous if this wasn't such a serious matter. Continuing, the sixth paragraph of his article reads, quote, the Montgomery, Alabama-based civil rights organization first started keeping tabs on Mission to Israel in October of 1992 when it turned up in a publication of the anti-Semitic racist Christian identity movement. The term Christian identity is now used in association with anti-Semitic and racist. The Christian Israel, or identity movement, has been attacked by the media so often that even the word identity has become a buzzword for most people, again, to engender certain response, used to conjure up all kinds of evil connotations. Well, let me set the record straight. The word identity is a common, harmless English word. Look it up for yourselves in your dictionaries. Webster's dictionary's definition, for example, reads thusly, identity, sameness as distinguished from similitude and diversity. We speak of the identity of goods found, the identity of persons, or of personal identity. End of that quote. That's how the word is employed by those who use it. It's called the Christian identity movement, or Israel identity movement, because it's easily proven that there has been a case of mistaken identity when it comes to the modern descendants of the Israelites of the Bible. Rather than being those today who most people believe are Israelites, it's someone else. And as a result, those who know and teach these facts have sometimes called themselves either Israel or Christian identity in clearing up this case of mistaken identity. But for simply pointing out that there's been a case of mistaken identity, those doing so, such as myself, are labeled as racist and white supremacist. Now I ask you, who's the real hate group here? Think about this. If because I, as a white man, claim to be a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, if that makes me a racist or a white supremacist, then why, please tell me, is it not racist or Jewish supremacy for a Jew to claim the same thing? Let me ask you this. Why am I labeled a racist or a white supremacist for teaching that the Celto-Saxon peoples are the true descendants of the biblical Israelites, when Jews who believe and teach the very same thing are never labeled as such? Such Jews as Harry Golden, whose article, Only in America, the Ten Lost Tribes, appeared in the April 20th, 1967 Heritage Southwest Jewish Press. How come Harry Golden, for teaching that the Celto-Saxons or Anglo-Saxon Germanic Scandinavian and kindred peoples are Israelites, how come he isn't labeled as anti-Semitic? As late as 1994, the same year that my book was printed, Yair Davidian, an Israeli Jew, in his 400 plus page book, documents essentially the same thing that my 400 plus page book does. And the whole book is devoted to this, but here's just from his introduction. His introductory notes on page Roman numeral 14, he wrote The Tribes, and that's the title of his book. The Tribes produces evidence that most of the ancient Israelites assimilated to foreign cultures and forgot their origins. In the course of time, they reached the British Isles and Northwest Europe, whence related nations such as the USA were founded. End of his quote. Alfred Lilienthal wrote in his book, What Price Israel, on page 223, quote, here's a paradox, a most ingenious paradox, an anthropological fact. Many Christians may have much more Hebrew Israelite blood in their veins than most of their Jewish neighbors. End of quote. Even New York Mayor Ed Koch, in the March 30th, 1987, U.S. News and World Report, you can look up any of these sources and find any of this for yourself. You can go to the library and get this if you want to check and see if this is actually in there. But in the March 30th, 1987, U.S. News and World Report, under a picture wherein he is pictured, Mayor Ed Koch is pictured embracing Cardinal John O'Connor, we find the following caption. It says, quote, it was St. Patrick's Day in America, and the Irish dyed the river green in Chicago, tinted the snow emerald in the Massachusetts mountains, and painted the center stripe down Fifth Avenue in shamrock hues, so New York's 125,000 marchers wouldn't go astray. For one day, everyone was Irish. Cardinal John O'Connor had a warm embrace for Mayor Ed Koch, who explained his presence at the head of the grand parade thusly, quote within a quote, it's part of my roots. The 10 lost tribes of Israel, we believe, ended up in Ireland. End of quote within a quote and end of quote. Now, are you going to accuse? Is Mr. Newman going to label Mayor Ed Koch a racist and a white supremacist for saying that? Well, if not, then why am I? Now, if I'm saying the same thing that many Jews themselves declare, again, why am I being labeled a racist and a white supremacist? It simply doesn't make any sense. As a matter of fact, as I point out in my book, if the Celto-Saxon peoples are the true descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, then this is not white supremacy, but instead white servanthood. Because God called the Israelites, whoever they are, God called the Israelites to serve and bless the rest of the world. I should have thought to give you the reference for that, but I didn't, so I don't have it off the top of my head. But there's at least four or five places in the book of Isaiah, Old Testament book of Isaiah, and other places, 1 Peter chapter 2 as well, talks about how Israel was chosen to be a servant people, a servant race. In my book, I quote Pastor William J. Cameron, who in 1933... preached the following. This is a quote from what he preached. Quote, the true effect of race knowledge is not to feed our vanity or rouse our boastfulness. Rather, it should arouse a profound sense of responsibility. I lay it down as a rule that whenever the thought of race leads us to boastfulness or contempt, there is something false in it. The Bible is not a history of the human race at large, but one distinct strain of people amongst the family of races. All the other races are considered with reference to it. The Bible deals with one race which flows like a Gulf Stream through the ocean of humanity. As the actual Gulf Stream touches two continents and blesses the nations, so this race, in its origin, history, and destiny, was selected and equipped for the service of the nations. Of course, many people still have their own ideas about this, and that creates a difficulty. For when people get their own ideas about things, it always leads to confusion. A man will rise and demand, quote within a quote, by what right does God choose one race or people above another, end of quote, within a quote. I like that form of the question. It is much better than asking by what right God degrades one people beneath another, although that is implied. God's grading is always upward. If he raises up a nation, it is that other nations may be raised up through its ministry. If he exalts a great nation, an apostle of liberty or science or faith, it is that he might raise a degraded people to a better condition. The divine selection is not a prize, a compliment paid to the man or the race. It is a burden imposed. To appoint a chosen people is not a pandering to the racial vanity of a quote-unquote superior people. It is a yoke bound upon the necks of those who are chosen for a special service. end of my quote of quoting Pastor Cameron in my book. Unfortunately, there are true white supremacists and racists who do use the term identity. That cannot be denied, because that is the case. There are true, I believe that they're minority. I know that, at least to my knowledge, I don't know of any that would fit that bill that this ministry is involved with, but indeed there are some. Just as there are some racist and white supremacist in some Baptist, Catholic, Lutheran, and Methodist churches and other churches as well. But that does not make all Baptist, Catholics, etc. racist and white supremacist. I'll guarantee you that there are some racist and white supremacist in the media profession. So should we conclude from that Andy Newman is a white supremacist and racist? Of course not. How ridiculous. Back to the newspaper article. Next paragraph, first sentence reads, quote, "Identity maintains strong ties to anti-government extremists in the militias," end quote. With, of course, implications, of course, that this is true about me. First off, let me state again, not only is Mission to Israel not a militia organization, it's almost funny, not only have I never attended a militia meeting, I can't even think of anyone that I personally know who's in a militia. That's how far off base this article is. In the same paragraph, Mr. Newman brings up Klan Watch. And of course, by doing so, in the minds of many readers, this automatically associates me with the Klan. Well, once again, here's the truth. I've personally only known one man who was a Klan member, and I'm at least partially responsible for getting him out of the Klan and leading him to salvation in Christ. You know, bringing the Klan up and bringing the things that this man does, it's well-termed media terrorism. You know, people are concerned about terrorism in this country, and rightfully so, but don't forget there's media terrorism, and that's what's been done to myself and my family. Mr. Newman ought to be ashamed of himself for what he's done, at the very least. In a later paragraph, Mr. Newman continued, quote, "According to identity literature and civil rights groups that track the racist right wing, its members believe, first, that Jews are the spawn of Satan, two, that non-whites and Jews will be destroyed in a future race war. In this apocalyptic scenario, identity adherents say that they will be pitted against the Jewish-controlled federal government, so-called race traitors, and members of other races. Identity preachers tell their flocks to stockpile guns and food in preparation. And third, Anglo-Saxons and Northern Europeans are the true descendants of the 10 lost tribes of Israel." Mr. Newman, of course, would like his readers to believe that those beliefs represent me. Well, he's correct on only one of the three, i.e. that I believe that the Anglo-Saxon, Northern Europe, and Northern Europeans are the descendants of the lost 10 tribes of Israel, and actually all 12 tribes. And I'm not ashamed in the least to admit that, because the Bible, archaeology, and history proves it. Plain and simple. Next paragraph. He writes, I quote, "Identity's ideological roots can be traced to the 19th century and the publication of Identification of the British Nation with Lost Israel," end of quote. Again, he tries to make this sound like it just goes back as far as the 19th century. Untrue. But let me tell you, Mr. Newman wouldn't know whether it's true or not. Mr. Newman is no expert on any of this. He's just parroting what someone else has fed him. And in actuality, he doesn't even really know anything about the organization that fed him this material, or the man, Morris Dees, who runs it. He doesn't know, for example, that Morris Dees is an antichrist homosexual who even forced his wife to climb in bed with him with another man, which she divorced him over, which is all the documentation for that is available for anyone to find out. And who also hates a man who hates Christianity, specifically Christian identity, but Christianity as a whole, and would do everything in his power to see Christianity destroyed. Mr. Newman doesn't know that, because I can guarantee you he never bothered to check out his source. Mr. Newman simply does not know what he's talking about. However, he does have my book, in which I provide documented evidence to the fact that the identity of the Israelites with the Celto-Saxons was historically recorded 1,000 years prior to what he mentions in his article. With such adherence, I'm going to name those. I mean, there's many, many more than these, but names that you should recognize. With such adherence as King Alfred the Great of England, King Robert the Bruce of Scotland. The movie Braveheart was about King Robert the Bruce, who became the first king of Scotland in the 1300s. Well, King Robert the Bruce and about 25 other nobles got together when they had won their independence, and they wrote their Declaration of Independence for Scotland. And in that, which is reproduced in my book, in that they identify themselves as being descendants of the biblical Israelites. Also, Sir Francis Drake was an adherent to this belief. King James VI of Scotland, poet John Dryden, Alexander Cruden, Christians should recognize, who was responsible for compiling the well-known Bible Concordance of Alexander Cruden. Also, the 1775 governor of Connecticut, Jonathan Trumbull, Noah Webster, Thomas Jefferson, and Sir Walter Scott, just to name a few who were adherents to this belief far before the time that Mr. Newman or Mr. Dees would have you believe that this thing became a belief system or whatever. Continue with a newspaper article. Mr. Newman writes, quote, "In God's Covenant People, Yesterday, Today, and Forever," which is the title of my book, and if for no other reason, at least he'd advertise my book. Anyway, quote, "In God's Covenant People, Yesterday, Today, and Forever," Weiland quotes from several notoriously anti-Semitic works and writers, end of quote. Now note at this point, he doesn't name anyone. Well, just who are these notorious anti-Semites? You know, he doesn't name them, but so who are they? However, earlier in this article, he did mention that we carry Henry Ford's. That's right, Henry Ford, the founder of the Ford Motor Company, that we carry Henry Ford's book, The International Jew. A book, by the way, which he used to place on the front seat of every car he sold in the past. But so what? So what if we carry Henry Ford's book? Anyone can get the same book down at our local library through interlibrary loan. And so is the library to be identified as being anti-Semitic because they carry the book? Mr. Newman also mentioned that this ministry carries an empire of their own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood, by Neil Gabler. Well, what Mr. Newman fails to tell you is that Neil Gabler is himself a Jew. And so what if I carry that book? You can go down to Copperfield's bookstore and buy the book. So does that make Copperfield's bookstore anti-Semitic? How ridiculous. Why didn't Mr. Newman mention that we also carry a book entitled Jews Must Live? That's right, a book entitled Jews Must Live by Samuel Roth, another Jewish man. Well, I'll tell you why. It's because that title doesn't fit in with the smear job that Mr. Newman was wanting to do against me. Or possibly because that wouldn't sell as many newspapers. That particular title, bringing that title up, wouldn't sell as many newspapers. Mr. Newman wrote, quote, "Weiland quotes from several notoriously anti-Semitic works and writers," end quote. Well, if he intended to give an honest and fair representation of myself and my book, why didn't he also mention that my book has over 700 fully documented quotes, quoting 373 different authors and sources, and that 155 of those are Jewish sources and authors, such as the 1905 Jewish Encyclopedia, the 1942 Universal Jewish Encyclopedia, the 1966 Standard Jewish Encyclopedia, the 1971 Encyclopedia Judaica, and the 1981 Jewish Almanac, again, just to name a few. Why didn't he bring those up? Those don't, I don't know about you, but those don't sound very anti-Semitic to me, and maybe that's why he didn't want to mention those. Had Mr. Newman really wanted to be fair, don't you think that he would have made mention of this, of those books, giving you a fair representation of myself and my book? But fairness and honesty doesn't sell a lot of newspapers, does it? At least in this day and age. No wonder Christ warned us to beware of the scribes. Back to the newspaper article. Quote, Weiland contends that the Jewish Talmud approves of sacrificing children to idols, pedophilia, engaging in sex with animals, and murder. End of quote. I did no such thing, and Mr. Newman knows it. I did not contend this. I quoted from the Talmud. I should have gotten you the page number in my book, but it's in the book. Here, but I can provide you the Talmudic references for those very things. Sanhedrin 64a, and you can look these up for yourself this way. Sanhedrin 64a for child sacrifices. Sanhedrin 54b for pedophilia. Yabamoth 59b for bestiality. And murder is also promoted in Sanhedrin 78a. Now, I understand that some people may not want to hear about that. I understand that. But the Apostle Paul does admonish us in Ephesians 5:11. He wrote, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but rather reprove them. Or the New American Standards renders the last part, but rather expose them. And so I'm just trying to do, at least in this particular case, trying to follow the admonition of the Apostle Paul as inspired by the Holy Spirit of God. Mr. Newman then wrote, quote, while most of his animus is aimed at Jews, he also denigrates American Indians, blacks, and Asians. He maintains they are morally inferior to whites and incapable of attaining high levels of civilization, end of quote. That's simply another lie. Nowhere in my book do I maintain that Indians, blacks, and Asians are morally inferior to the white man. I do point out that there is a difference in the natural morality of the different races. And that's, I mean, life shows us that. It's just the way it is. Different races of people in their own cultures have different sets of morality. That's just simply undeniable. And that, by the way, let me back up and let me just say it again. I do point out that there is that kind of difference. But that is quite different from what Mr. Newman wrote and implied in what I supposedly believe. For example, I teach that all races can share in salvation. I did a four-part series recently entitled Salvation, Israelite and Non-Israelite Alike. I point out in that message, according to Isaiah 56, the stranger or any non-Israelite who joins himself to God has a better name before God than even the Israelite who comes to God through Christ. In other words, I believe that a non-Israelite and any non-individual Israelite who would come to God through Christ has a better name before God than even I do when I believe that I'm an Israelite. I think anybody's going to have a hard time believing that that could be racist when I believe that way. We have both Native Americans and blacks on our tape ministry who receive our tapes, and I have yet to ever have any of them ever take offense at anything that I've preached. And I would wager that I have sent more Bibles to black Nigerians than any other ministry or church in the valley, or for the whole state for that matter. Mr. Newman ends his article by pointing out my association with Pastor Pete Peters, another Christian pastor who has been maliciously lied about. Mr. Newman would have you to believe that Pastor Peters, quote, once hosted members of a racist terrorist group called the Order at his church before they were convicted, end of quote. Hosted? It's really funny. And again, it's just another blatant lie. It is true that David Lane, an Order member, did once attend church at the LaPorte Church of Christ in Colorado. However, here's the truth of the matter. He stormed out and slammed the door behind him in the middle of one of Pastor Peter's messages because he didn't like what Pastor Peter's was preaching. But all of the reports that have used this and slandered Pastor Peter's in this way that Mr. Newman is just parroting never mentioned that fact. No, they'd want to immediately try to associate Pastor Peter's or anyone who would associate with Pastor Peter's as being associated with the order when it's absolutely a false lie and distortion of the truth. I don't know about you, but I'd say that there is a lot of difference between the truth and what Mr. Dees and Mr. Newman would have you to believe about Pastor Peter's, myself, and Mission to Israel Ministries. Let me tell you, the people of this community ought to rise up and demand Mr. Newman's resignation. My family and I will have to live with this. While Mr. Newman is probably going to be allowed to go on in his profession slandering others. And who knows, you might be next. You know, this is the kind of article, the kind of grandstanding by a reporter that may even get him a promotion, when instead he should be forced to resign. There's no way that I can undo the harm done to my family and my reputation by Mr. Newman's article. I've even prayed to God that he would protect us from reprisals, which I'm confident that he will. However, that doesn't make being lied about and being put in an unfavorable light enjoyable. I don't enjoy this at all, and let me assure you, I especially don't enjoy having my family put through this. However, as I pointed out in last Sunday's message, their words must not be feared. We must not let their words, their lies, dictate to us what we do or we do not do. Because if we were to do so, then they would become our quote-unquote gods. It's His, God's word, that must dictate to us the direction of our lives, not the lying pens of the scribes. As I stated in the previous message, they may have the power to influence public opinion, although I think that's diminishing greatly. But they may have still some semblance of power to influence influence public opinion, but they will never, never sway God's opinion. And it's His opinion that I'm most concerned with. And I hope you are too. Well, how do I end such a message? I do know this, that if you are going to speak the truth, you must be prepared to be slandered or lied about, or maybe even worse. Truth, by the enemies of truth, is usually combated by lies. Christ said this. In John 15 and verse 20, He stated, "Remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they have persecuted me, they will also persecute you." And then He also admonished us in Matthew 5 and verses 10 through 12, where He said, "Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which came before you." What can I say? How can I end this message? Well, I can say, let's rejoice. Praise God that He has counted us worthy to suffer shame for His name.
Hello? Well, guess who called me the other day? A TV reporter from down in L.A. He said he heard a song a little while ago on some obscure talk radio show. Then he asked if I was the writer of the music I just mentioned in the lyrics above. But now that I look back at the wisdom I lacked, I probably never should have said too much. And as he pressured me to share with him a word or two, and we carried on a telephonic interview, a wee steel voice inside my head was saying, "You're gonna be sorry for every word you just said." And sure enough, right after he was through, he slandered and defamed me on the evening news. I should have listened instead to the voice inside my head, cause here's what it said to me. You don't go casting your pearls before swine, cause they're only gonna trample them into the muck and grime. And when they're through, they'll turn on you and burn you every time. So don't go casting your pearls before swine. And when I went off to sing a song in Washington, I was hounded by this dirty dog, CNN, who said they wanted to do a favor for me by giving me a little free publicity. I should have never let them turn their lying cameras on, cause when the cutting and the editing was finally done, they put horns on my head by changing everything I said. They made me sound like the devil's own son. So you don't go casting your pearls before swine, cause you're only gonna trample them into the muck and grime. And when they're through, they'll turn on you and smear you every time. So don't go casting your pearls before swine. Now there's ABC, and then there's NBC, CBS, CNN, New York Times, the LA Times, and the Washington Post, just a few of the most porkiest people. NBC called to let me know they're gonna use the music on a TV show. They're gonna use the song I wrote about the wrong that happened up in Ruby Ridge, Idaho. But then they got a threatening letter from the ADO that said, you use that kind of music, we'll make your life hell. Then they dropped me off the show, and now I think I know why the music doesn't sell that well. So you don't go casting your pearls before swine, cause you're only gonna trample them into the muck and grime. And when they're through, they'll turn on you and rip you every time. So don't go casting your pearls before swine. No, you don't go casting your pearls before swine. Said you don't go casting your pearls to them sanctimonious media boys and girls. You don't go casting your pearls before swine.